Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and if you've never spent much time in New Mexico, you don't really have a sense of the full complexity of American racial history. And when I moved there, I certainly didn't know very much about it. And 7 years later, I knew a whole lot about things like land grants that I really never knew before. And so to expand on this, we thought we'd invite Lorena Oropesa, who is a professor of history and interim associate vice chancellor for academic diversity, the University of California at Davis, to discuss her recent book, The King of Adobe, Reyes Lopez Tijerina, Lost Prophet of the Chicano Movement. Lorena, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Would you talk a little bit about your project and, you know, this incredibly complicated and fascinating individual who is Reyes Lopez Tijerina?
Yeah, Reyes Lopez Tijerina, the hard part was to write a history book and not a telenovela, right? He's a man who is an extremely complicated, mesmerizing, deeply insightful, and sometimes repulsive human being. So the way I usually describe this book to people who aren't familiar with the Chicano movement or Mexican-American history is that Reyes Lopez Tijerina was the militant alternative to Cesar Chavez. And this book is a biography of him. And he's most well known for leading a raid, an armed raid on a county courthouse in northern New Mexico. And that raid, at the end of it, two people were shot, not killed, but shot. Two people were kidnapped. And one person was pistol whipped really brutally. And so it's a moment of violence. In the 1960s, there's a lot of like chants and a lot of like, you know, by any means necessary. There's not actually a lot of moments where the people actually pick up a gun and start shooting. This is one of those moments. And it was something that sent him into the stratosphere as far as national news coverage. And I wanted to unlock, like, who was this guy? What the heck happened there? Because a lot of the coverage of him, even though he's rapidly recognized as a hero to the Chicano movement, it's like it doesn't really explain how he got there. So that did mean delving into the longer history of land grants and the long struggle to reclaim land that had been taken from Spanish-speaking people in northern New Mexico following the U.S.-Mexico War. And I am realizing that is a really long sentence, but what happens is this is an incident that occurs on one day, June 5th, 1967, but you start pulling the threads and all of a sudden you're 200 years back, you know, 300 years back. You're talking about like conquest, another conquest, not the American conquest, but the Spanish conquest. So I really wanted to figure out more about this man and what he was about and what propelled him. So that's what the book really focuses on.
Yeah, I mean, when I was thinking about this podcast, I was thinking, wow, you know, this is going to be a lot of material to cover in a short amount of time because the threads are so long and so complicated. And you know, so I guess we have to break that down a little bit. And, you know, I assume that most of our readers, some probably do, but most probably don't know that much about the land grant situation in New Mexico. So could you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. And I'm going to do it with the notion that lawyers are in a part of this audience here.
Definitely.
So I just want you to know the U.S. State Department, every U.S. agency has always ruled that everything done with the land grants is all perfectly well done and in keeping with a peace treaty that ended the U.S.-Mexico War in 1848. That is the stance of the U.S. Government as late as the latest report was in 2004. It's like they're saying we honor the letter of the law. That same treaty said that all land owned by Mexican citizens at the time the United States took over the north of Mexico, which becomes the American Southwest, that land would be respected and honored. Land property rights would be honored. And so what happens is it is the courts of the conquerors, it's American courts saying, yeah, we're working within American law. This is all great. The people of New Mexico, Spanish speaking of New Mexico, have a different opinion of that. And the power of Reyes Lopez Tijerina was that he spent a lot of time talking to people about what happened. So one way to do this quickly is to think about what he learned. And so he's originally from Texas, but in the late 1950s, he's in New Mexico. He's a fugitive from the law. That's another part of the story. But he is really interested in why there's so many Spanish-speaking people who are so darn poor. And it turns out that their ancestors had been deeded land by the Spanish crown or the Mexican government. And then after the U.S.-Mexico War of 1846-1848, that land quickly became the property of either individual American citizens or the U.S. government. And how did that happen? That's what he wants to know. And sometimes you have shifty lawyers. Sometimes you have unscrupulous judges and courts. A lot of times you have, sheer poverty. There's a new tax system. There's a new, the one big problem was that all Mexican citizens were asked to prove that they were the property owners. That didn't happen when the U.S. took over Louisiana or Florida, right? So, you know, you've been here 100 years, now give me your documents. It's like, well, that might be hard to find. So some people did hold on to documents, but they were never considered good enough by the American courts. The upshot is that in New Mexico, 80% of land holdings by Spanish-speaking people become someone else's property within 50 years. And although this process of land disposition happens across the New American Southwest, because in New Mexico, you've had more people there for much longer. You had probably as many as 100,000 people, and Spanish colonization starts in New Mexico, so it starts in 1598. There's like this critical mass of people who are still mad as hell in the 1960s. I mean, they remember that their grandfather used to be able to pasture their cattle, and now they have to go ask permission from the U.S. Forest Service to and get it. Like, well, you can have 10 cattle this winter, you can have 15 cattle. So they're completely beholden to what they see as a colonial master or the power, the oppressive power, which would be the U.S. government. Yeah. Does that help?
Very much so. Yes. And so you mentioned that, you know, Tiarina was a fugitive from the law at before he sort of started getting into this land grant issue. Could you talk a little bit more about this fascinating character? And as you point out earlier, sometimes repulsive character, who is Reyes Lopez Tiarina? And how does he get interested in, and how does he sort of start moving into being serious about the land grant issue?
Yeah, well, getting... the bare bones of Reyes Lopez Tiarina's biography was already known when I did this book. And the bare bones go, he's born in Texas, he's raised during the Great Depression, he becomes a Bible student, he's an independent minister, and then he's interested in the land grants and formed an organization in 1963 called La Alianza Federal de Mercedes, a federal alliance, like we're going to grant all land grant people together, and Mercedes is a land grant. So that's the bare bones. And then in 67, he leads his courthouse raid that gives him national fame for a short time. I needed to take a deeper look, and I needed to take a deeper look on two trajectories. One is I really needed to explore how much his faith meant to him. So he wasn't just a itinerant minister. He grew up dirt poor. I'm 26. We grew up during the Great Depression. The only book he had was a Bible. It becomes his framework for understanding life itself. Like why are Mexican origin people screwed over in the United States, to put it most bluntly, right? And it's because the United States is a capitalist, cruel, racist nation that mistreats people. That's what his conclusion was. And he looked to the Bible to find those answers. He noticed that the word justice was there as much as love and mercy. Though love and mercy was not really bad. Getting justice was what he wanted to do. So he ends up going to a Bible school. He becomes a Pentecostal minister. So that's the Assemblies of God. Now, the Assemblies of God is one of the biggest Pentecostal groups in the United States today, in the globe today. And it's really interesting because it's filled with people who would consider on the right wing of the political spectrum. Dillon was very much on the left wing, and he was actually too extreme for even the Assemblies of God. So they kick him out. He's an independent minister. He is so convinced that he can not only divine, like understand God's role for him in the world, he's convinced that he has personal communications, he has visits with angels, he has inspirational dreams, that in the late 1950s, he started in a commune in Arizona to await the end of the world. And at this point, he decides, he tells his followers, or at least some of them, that he's a prophet of God, known as Irateo, means wrath of God, or that's what he says it means. And the problem is when you decide to live in the desert, really the desert in Arizona, it's hard conditions, and you still have to eat, and he's arrested for stealing. And instead of showing up in court and copping to the crime, he becomes a fugitive in New Mexico. And he goes to New Mexico, and what he does is he takes that same sense of like same thirst for justice, the same sense that God is on his side, and he just applies all the force of his personality to wanting to seek justice for land-grant people. That's the first trajectory. The second is related, and it's because it has to do with the position of women in his organization, in his family, and let me tell you, they're one and the same. So the only way that Diarina can learn about land grants, the only way he can actually survive, whether he's a minister doing his own thing or whether he's a land grant leader doing his own thing, which is like 100% dedication to La Causa or La Misión, he calls them both a sainted crusade, right? He's either waiting the end of the world and the rapture, or he's waiting for land grant justice, or working towards both, is that he really cruelly exploits the women in his family. And when it comes to his first wife, Mary Escobar, that means physical abuse. When it comes to his eldest daughter, and I mean, there's a lot I left out of the book, but the eldest daughter may not have been alone. I mean, statistics say she probably wasn't. It was sexual abuse. And so the challenge for me, and also, I mean, the eldest daughter also worked 10 years as an unpaid secretary. So that tells you another form of exploitation. And so the challenge for me was, how do you weave all these parts together, right? He's like a man who abuses his family. He's repulsive at points. And then he's a man who has these deep insights about the nature of American empire and democracy, right? And he's constantly trying to find a way forward. So.
Well, how did you manage to tie those threads together, I guess, right? I mean, it's just in terms of writing this book and this incredible story, you know, I mean, as somebody who's read it and thought it was great, how did you manage to sort of keep this incredible vision of Tyrion as this fighter for justice combined with, you know, what is in many ways a really awful person?
So, well, for one thing, it took me a really long time. And for another thing, this never has happened. Anything I would have like multiple versions. Like this was chapter one, but oh, this was chapter one in 2015. Not the way. So what happened is my first takes were always these long 70-page chapters that were filled with qualifications. Because when people say it was mercurial, he really was. He would say something like on April 5th and then say the exact opposite on April 6th. So how do you make sense of this man? And then he had such a good sense of himself that he kept writing about himself. So when you go to his archive, is what he said about a certain event accurate? The version he said in 67 or in 57 or in 77, like things, it was just this forever shifting. So I did a good job. I think one day I was smart enough to ask a dear friend of mine who is not a historian. He's just a smart, kind man. And he made me sit down and really talk about Diarina for, I think, 3 hours straight. It was painful. And at the end of it, I realized, I mean, probably painful for me and probably really horrible for Dan, but God bless him. At the end of it, I realized that I had the beginning of a key, which is that I took all the parts of him that were qualifications or were in conflict, and using his religious vision as a through line, I eventually segregated him into different facets of his personality over time. So it was really easy to see that the first chapter was going to be the King of Kings, because this man is named after Jesus Christ, El Rey de los Reyes, and he really did have like a Messiah complex. The second one was a prophet. When he's a prophet in Casa Grande, then he becomes a Mexican because he's going to lead these new Mexicans. He's an evangelist and that he has a land grant gospel. So those were kind of, and then it got really hard. Like, what is the next chapter about? And so, they came, the martyr, the Chicano, they all came eventually, but it was like a matter of like corralling him. I mean, he was such an expansive person. And it's not like sometimes you go into a project, and it's like, oh my God, there's nothing written. What am I going to do? In this case, it was almost like there was too much, right? It was like you're in a massive echo chamber, and it's like the Diarina show run by Diarina. So yeah. And then I went and interviewed him, and that was even weirder. Yeah.
Yeah. I can only imagine that. So how do we get to a point where you have this guy who is not from New Mexico and sort of discovers the land grant issue to within a few years is leading an armed raid on a county courthouse in Tierra Amarilla? Like, how does that happen?
Well, one is he gets a 5-year sabbatical to really become an expert on land grant matters by virtue of his wife working nonstop to support him and their 6 children. I mean, I would know a lot about something if I spent 5 years working on it nonstop. And two is that, you know, you have to remember he was a Pentecostal. All he did was preach. Like, he would preach for hours, and it was hours at a time. He had no problem. It was like, oh, I got to prepare. Like, he could get up and just start talking. And he brought all of that passion and sense of righteousness to this land grant mission. And because he knew what he was talking about, what he really encouraged people to do was to form a federation of all land grants. Because what would happen is land grant people would fight against each other or try to pursue these really complicated, incredibly detailed legal claims one-on-one. And he said, forget that. We're going to all get together and we're going to expose this injustice. And then we're going to go petition the two signatories of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, this 1848 peace treaty. And then, like, justice will flow. It's like almost like a boiler. You know, if you puncture it, then everything will, like, get better after that. So that was his, and he was so inspirational. Like, it's, I really think he was more powerful speaking in Spanish than in English. So, you know, sometimes when you see him, there are video clips. You can go find video clips of him. And sometimes he seems like a little off, but some in Spanish, he's like, oh my God, like, people are crying when they hear him. Like, there are people who are ready to believe he's a prophet of sorts. Yeah. So it was partly his charismatic personality, partly his deep knowledge, partly his absolute dedication, and his ability to convince people, if we all pull together, this is your moment, this is your chance. And it helped that the people in New Mexico were really desperate by then. They had been shut down from so many court avenues. The younger generation was leaving the land grants. It was almost like seeing the end of their way of life after more than 150 years up north. And so, you know, like, his message and the way, and the people who were receiving it, it was a good fit.
Well, and there had been, I mean, so if we want to sort of pull back to the people in northern New Mexico for a second, I mean, there had been a level of tension that could lead to low levels of violence, like attacks on the Forest Service and things like that in the years before this, right? So they're not a totally, you know, they had already thought about these things and had acted on them in some ways.
They've been, yeah. So one of the real purposes of this book is to, it's not a book about the New Mexican land grant movement, because that would be a book of many chapters, of which Theodine is only one, mm-hmm. right? So what Theodine does is he takes a long existing struggle and he gives a kind of a national platform. And so up north in particular, there had been court cases, there had been scattered hay burnings, scattered, you know, fence cuttings. In the late 1800s, there were attempts to bring up railroad ties that were, you know, taking over. This is all hello, the Americans are coming in. Industry is coming in. No, you can't use the land the way you want to. So there had always been protest. It was just, it hadn't met with success yet. And one of the most devastating rulings comes in 1896 when the U.S. Supreme Court, because what New Mexicans really want is access to the commons. They know that they don't usually have proof of, like, this individual parcel belongs to me and mine, but they think they have access to land that's held in common that they can use to, you know, harvest timber or gather water or pasture their animals. And the U.S. Supreme Court says, like, no, the land in common was really held by the King of Spain, and then it was held by the Republic of Mexico, and now it's held by the U.S. Forest Service. You know what I mean? Well, it's held by the U.S. government, and the U.S. Forest Service comes 10 years later. Yeah. So, you know, it's difficult. It's really difficult. So it's like, but you have to be really careful, because I don't want anyone to read this book or hear this podcast and think, like, oh, Theodine came in as a savior. He would love that interpretation. The man died in 2015, and he would absolutely agree with that interpretation, but it would not be correct, right? There's people who struggled a long time before he came, and there's people who continue to struggle today. His was just, because that courthouse raid was so dramatic, and because it was a moment of heightened social activism, you know, late 1960s, people were paying attention to race. It really did get him national attention. The land grant caused national attention for the first time ever. Yeah, and it's attention that faded, you know, in time.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's partially fascinating here is that so many of these figures that, you know, major leaders that come out of the late 1960s, if they survive, they have pretty long careers, in some of which, like a Jesse Jackson, let's say, is still, you know, still very much around today, and many, many others. And of course, this is not the case for Tiarina. But he, you know, one thing I think that you take from the book, and if you weren't familiar with this, you'd be surprised, is that raid really launches him into the true pinnacle of social justice leadership in the United States, to the point where he plays a huge role in the Poor People's Campaign, and he's truly a national figure, and then it screeches to a halt pretty fast. What? How does the raid launch him to that point, and how does he burn those bridges in such an unbelievable way?
Yeah. Well, he would say that he was persecuted by Christ. That's why he disappeared from the scene. But he was in a certain extent. That's part of the story. But let's first say how he got to the stratosphere. So, I mean, by the time the 67 raid comes up, the UFW has already been on strike since 65. So there's a little bit more attention to Mexican Americans. And if you're looking at the 1960s in general, it's already past the Civil Rights Act, past the Voting Rights Act, right? So there's already a lot of attention for the past decade has been placed on Black civil rights. There's just a greater awareness, I think, in the United States about its racial past. And so he kind of strikes that flame at the right moment. And it's literally within weeks after the courthouse raid that he's getting a telegram from Martin Luther King Jr. saying, please help us plan the Poor People's Campaign. Now, the truth is, a theater that's not really good at sitting in meetings and coming up with logistics about planning anything. But he's really good at like standing up in front of people and getting people like really excited or riled up or like articulating injustice. So at the Poor People's Campaign, he participates in several protests. One is at the U.S. State Department. You know, and you think like, what the hell does the U.S. State Department have to do with New Mexico and Mexican Americans there? And he's saying this is the story of American empire. I mean, it's part of his brilliance, right? It's connecting those dots. He also, and this is really telling about his own thinking about conquests and multiple conquests, especially New Mexico, he also participates in a raid in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. And this is a raid organized by Native Americans at the Poor People's Campaign to protect their fishing rights, which were under assault. And so he is, you know, he's always there to denounce the injustice. Every time he's on trial, it's kind of funny because like even his own defense lawyers will say, or try to ask him a question, he's going to say whatever the heck he wants to say. He's going to give you a 400-year history in 20 minutes or less. Like, they cannot rein him in. So he is just, he's who he is. He's a man who knows how to speak. But what he doesn't do, and what he never had, was like a plan beyond that. He really, if you look really carefully at the documents that he articulated, it's like, no. Once the justice is exposed, it's going to be okay. Like, if you just, like, this horrible crime that's stinking up the pages of New Mexican history, like, as long as, like, he really had a faith in the power of justice. So part of his, like, quick denouement, how do you, I'm not, you know, quick end, quick unraveling, you can fix it. Quick unraveling is that he, I think there's a part of him that's a little bit heartbroken, right? He first of all expects the world to end on a certain time and date. That doesn't happen. And then he has like all faith that if he only pours his energy into this cause, justice will prevail. That did not happen, although the land grant movement does continue in New Mexico. So that's part of the rise. Do you want me to say a little bit about the fall? Because it really has a lot to do with these longer threads that are, it's the more the telenovela aspect of him.
Go ahead, please.
Okay. One is that he, you know, the way you get ahead, I mean, think about it. He has almost no education. He's an outsider, and he still says, listen to me and I'm going to lead you to justice. That is a massive ego at work. And that massive ego got in the way eventually. The Poor People's Campaign, they took to calling him TV Rena, because like if there was a microphone or a camera, it's like, I can speak. He doesn't really have a planner. He's not a political planner. He's not a strategist. He's an orator, or as Maria Varela, a member of SNCC who became involved in New Mexican justice. He was a preacher. He wasn't a protest organizer. He wasn't an organizer. So that weakness comes to the fore because he really has nothing more to offer except kind of saying, as some of his critics said, like the same thing over and over again. Right. And so he comes back to the Poor People's Campaign and goes, oh, I'm going to run for governor. Well, no one wants to vote for him. you know, very few people want to vote for him. And he also, his legal troubles start to mount. So he ends up going to prison between mid 69 to mid 71 on federal charges because of an earlier protest, not the raid, but an earlier one that occurred in 67 on federal land. And he comes out and he's kind of stranger than ever in a way. And that he's more insistent that people pay attention to him. There's evidence that he was, well, it's for sure that he spent all of his, most of his time at a psychiatric hospital within the federal prison system. And so, you know, he's struggling and he's not being listened to in the same way. The Chicano movement has kind of gone on without him. He's in his 40s, they're in their young 20s. They don't want to like take orders, they're rebelling, man. And so, so in the 1970s, he's desperate to keep centering himself. So he gets involved in the land-grant movement in Texas. He takes more trips to Mexico. By the 1980s, he can't seem to keep himself from saying what he really thinks. And one of the things he really thinks is that people he calls the Jews, and I'm putting that in quotation marks, are out to take over the world. So his anti-Semitic comments are unguarded and profuse. He becomes much more open about his, like, if you're always trying to see the work of God or the hand of God in human history, you're going to look for clues. Like, he gets into numerology, he gets into like family genealogy. Like, it's like the first thing he asked me, because my last name is Oropesa, that is a Jewish name before the Inquisition, right? Because of usury, who is weighing the gold, pesando el oro. You know, so, and then, but he looks at me like with suspicion, and then he looks, I kid you not, at my nose and decides it's acceptable. So this is like, he kind of, like, as someone said, like, there's a lot, let me just put it this way, there's a lot I did not put in the book. And as someone said, and this is in the book, like, he becomes known more as a weirdo than a hero. And then adding to this is like, the rumors in New Mexico is like, rumors so much that they're even worse than I think the reality. Is like, did he fiddle with his daughters? And fiddle sounds like such a, oh gosh, like I'm making light of it. I'm not. It was, let me tell you, that was one of the hardest parts of the books to write. Did he inappropriately touch the genitalia of his daughter? And the answer is yes. He said yes. The answer is yes, he did touch. His answer is it was not inappropriate. It's completely within his bounds as the patriarch, as the father.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously we're dealing with one of the most complicated figures in many ways in American history, right? He taps into this moment, becomes famous, then it's forgotten about or marginalized, self-marginalized. And so I guess, you know, as we think about the last few minutes here of our conversation, I guess, you know, there's two questions. One is, okay, so what is going on? You know, if you could tell us a little bit about what's going on with land grant movements since then and, you know, what his legacy is within New Mexico. But then also I think, and we can separate these out, but what should, for those people who are interested in racial justice, who are interested in justice generally, what are the lessons that we can take, or at least what is the takeaway about a figure such as Tiarina, who is maybe inspiring in a sense, but obviously is horrifying in another sense. So I guess those are two totally separate questions, but if you want to address either of them.
So one of my takeaways is that people are really complicated, right? So someone can have really deep insights about the nature of American empire and still act in ways that are, I mean, people we really admire, like, I think if you look under the rug, you know, that's the wrong metaphor, but if you look more deeply at the history of other people, it's like, Cesar Chavez had completely complicated family relations, right? Martin Luther King Jr. did too. I mean, it's just like, it is not, and never mind all those white men, political leaders who are like messy. They're messy. People, I mean, oftentimes I think that people who want power or seek power are kind of like messy, you know? and it's not to excuse anything that he said or did. And to the contrary, I did a good job documenting it. But it's like, that's one of my takeaways. I think the victory for Tiarina is not about land grant. Like, he didn't get it. There's no lack that comes to any Alianza member because they joined the organization, not a single acre. The land grant struggle continues in New Mexico. So on that level, I think what the parallel I draw is to reparations right? Like I don't know, when I first heard of that, I said, sounds like a good idea. No way in heck that's ever going to happen, right? I mean, this was like 20 years ago. It's been going on for a long time. But then if you look at the latest stimulus plan from DC, it includes $5 billion for Black farmers. It does include like a nod to this idea that there was an injustice done that needs to be addressed today. So in a way, I think that, you know, that might be hold out hope for land-grant people in New Mexico. The greater victory of Dearina is not about the land grants per se. It's really about how we think about American history. And so, you know, I mean, for those nerdy historians among us, like this idea of like westward expansion was conquest, New Mexico, Hawaii are colonies, that Native Americans live on the reservations are, you know, a form of colonization. Now we say, oh yeah, sure. But no one was saying that in the 1950s when Dearina started thinking along these lines. And so that was a real victory, and a willingness to look hard at American history and our racial past and our imperial past. I think that's important. And I think that is something that he contributed that has been entirely overlooked. And he didn't do it by himself, but he certainly did do it. But there's and I think that willingness to look hard at American history is important because I don't know. I mean, I'm sure it was, you know, we all paid attention to the last administration, that 1776 report, like, hi, well, you know, if you teach American history, it's like a patriotic endeavor, right? And so, I mean, that's like, there's such a, it just reminds me so much of New Mexican history, because for so long, New Mexicans were told that, you know, if there was anything went wrong, it was their fault. They were too poor, too lazy, or too stupid, or too backward to understand what was really going on. And given that you know, it all happened a long time ago, it's best just to forget and move on, that Dearina really addressed that kind of deeper injustice. And I think that's important. Yeah. You know, I'm not into forgetting as a historian. I guess that's the easiest way to put it.
Yeah, forgetting is bad. And, you know, it's an interesting time, actually, on these issues, as so much of our past is being rehashed now and causing people, you know, enormous stress. And in the case of Charlottesville, dying in the streets over various interpretations of our past. And so, you know, I think that and certainly you've seen that in New Mexico as well, with, you know, discussions of Oñate and mm-hmm. land grants and stuff. Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to add, because the Oñate thing, I've alluded to it briefly, but one of, I think, Dearina's most interesting insights was the way he most directly dealt with the Native American inheritance, cultural, but also genetic, of New Mexicans and all Mexican American people. I mean, when I say New Mexicans, I mean Nuevo Mexicano, Spanish-speaking New Mexicans or people. And so, you know, because the easy way to dismiss his whole effort was like, well, the Spaniards stole it first. And it's like, the truth is that people show up in northern New Mexico are mixed race refugees from earlier conquests, right? So it's like they are both extending the empire and a product of conquest. And so to get to those complications and to honestly recognize the close relations, I mean, Dearina really did, this is part of his... If you dig deeper, it's actually part of his racism. But he did identify more closely with Native Americans in their struggle than African Americans. And he did because he said the Native American struggle was about land. And this is the point of commonality he felt with them.
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. Well, this is a great place to end in this discussion of memory. And Lorraine, I just want to thank you so much. This was a really wonderful conversation.
Thank you, Eric. I really appreciate you contacting me.
Yeah, you bet. So again, we've been speaking to Lorraine Oropesa. Her book, The King of Adobe, Reyes Lopez Tijerina, Lost Prophet of the Chicano Movement. That was published in 2019 by the University of North Carolina Press. And I very strongly suggest everybody picking up a copy and reading it for yourself. All right. Thank you. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,